said, fear me again. No, I'm your father. Remember that no one can breathe underwater.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Crapon, who's the founder and president emeritus of the Henry L. Stimson Center. He directs programming at the Stimson Center on South Asia, Arms Control, and Space Security, and previously worked in the Carter administration on Capitol Hill and at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's written and edited more than a dozen books, including Cooperative Threat Reduction, Missile Defense, and The Nuclear Future, Space Assurance or Space Dominance, The Case Against Weaponizing Space, Nuclear Risk Reduction in South Asia, and Better Safe Than Sorry, The Ironies of Living with the Bomb. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Crapon.
Thank you, Ian.
And the CIA has just come out with its, or the National Intelligence Council have just come out with its global focus report on the world in 2030, what it will look like. And most of it's to do with China's economy eclipsing the United States, although they don't say that China is going to become a hegemon like the United States. And by and large, I think most people could interpret this report as being fairly optimistic, I guess, about the future of the globe, although clearly there are problems with resource depletion, overpopulation. But no sense that the big powers are going to go at it, the U.S. and China, and Russia's fading. But where they say there are real signs of problems and where the world could be thrown for a loop and we could have some serious crises that could, in fact, affect the U.S.-China relations are to do with the 15 countries that are at high risk of state failure by 2030, among them Afghanistan, Pakistan, but also Burundi, Rwanda, Somalia, Uganda, and Yemen. So a long introduction, Michael, but you've been writing a lot and studying the nuclear posture of Pakistan. That seems to be what the CIA's 2030 report suggests, is that's the most likely nuclear war. And what's your sense of where the Pakistani nuclear arsenal stands and what kind of nuclear posture do they have?
Well, Pakistan's nuclear program is a success story as they see it. The rest of the world doesn't see it that way, but not much works very well in Pakistan. The one thing that does is the military has established requirements for nuclear weapons, and they're meeting those requirements. In fact, they seem to be ahead of India in terms of their stockpile size and their means to deliver nuclear weapons. It's odd. India is a much bigger country. It's a much richer country. But India's nuclear program is run by civilians, and civilians who don't think very much of the bomb. I think that the bomb is a political message sender. It's not a weapon of war. In Pakistan, the military runs the bomb program, and they think these weapons have military as well as political utility.
Well, my understanding is it's the fastest growing arsenal on the planet, and it has surpassed in numbers the French arsenal and perhaps the British.
They haven't gotten there yet, Ian, I don't think. But if they keep on the path they're on, they might.
And what about the externals, though? I mean, given this CIA report, the National Intelligence Council report on the globe the year 2030, this is the main bad news in the report, that we could have a nuclear war between India and Pakistan. What's leading them to come to that conclusion?
Well, the biggest stabilizing factor on the subcontinent so far has been that New Delhi, India's political leaders, have turned the other cheek. whenever they have been assaulted, grossly assaulted, with mass casualty attacks against iconic targets in the country by folks who have been trained and equipped in Pakistan. We've had several of these terrible mass casualty assaults. There was one on the Indian Parliament in 2001. The one we remember most recently were assaults on luxury hotels in Mumbai, Bombay, as well as a Jewish community center and the main train station. If these assaults had happened in the United States, say in Times Square, you can imagine, and your listeners can imagine, how the United States government would have responded. Look how we responded after 9/11. We engaged in two major trillion-dollar wars. India has had these kinds of experiences, and the leadership in India has concluded that it was not worth fighting a war, risking a war with Pakistan. It was not risking their economic growth pattern by fighting a war with Pakistan. Now, this has been their calculations in the past under two very different coalition governments. The question that everybody's puzzling over is whether India will respond in a similar way if this happens again in the future. So far, I believe, and this is so counterintuitive for us in the United States, but Pakistan has lost when these explosions have occurred in India without India firing a shot. Pakistan's national economy continues to tank. Its international standing continues to tank, while India's economic growth continues, and India's standing continues to grow. So this is very Eastern and hard to understand for us, but it's not clear to me that if and when there is another huge explosion in India, the Indian government will start a war over it.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Crapon, who's the founder and president emeritus of the Henry L. Stimson Center, where he directs programming at the Stimson Center on South Asia Arms Control and Space Security. He has an article at the Stimson Center, an essay on Pakistan's nuclear strategy and deterrence stability, and we're talking about this in the context of the just-released report from the National Intelligence Council on the global forecast for the year 2030, which has China emerging as the world's largest economy, but not necessarily as the world's hegemon. And in terms of bad news, it talks about the failed states, most prominent of which is Pakistan, and also talks about the possibility that things could really go awry with a possible nuclear war between Pakistan and India. What about this persistent fear on the part of the United States that sort of in many ways justifies our benighted policies in Afghanistan and vis-a-vis Pakistan, is that we have to engage this country because we can't possibly allow it to fail and the nuclear weapons to fall into the hands of jihadis. In many ways, that seems to be a kind of form of blackmail that the Pakistanis are conducting.
Ian, weakness pays. Weakness pays when you're dealing with the United States, and you are an important country. We have been giving billions of dollars to Pakistan over the last, well, since 2001. I think it's $24 billion or a similar number in economic and military assistance, partly because Pakistan has kind of had us over a barrel with respect to Afghanistan. The Bush administration, the Obama administration, really haven't had a clue how to gain leverage on Pakistan to get preferred outcomes in Afghanistan. And I think we're now coming to the reluctant but necessary conclusion that the outcome in Afghanistan is probably going to be about the same, regardless of how much we invest there and how much we invest in Pakistan. So my sense is that in the second Obama administration, we're going to invest less, a lot less, in both places. And I think that's probably necessary and wise.
Well, I recall that the attack by the Pakistani military ISI-equipped jihadis against the hotel in Mumbai and the train station and the Jewish center coincided with a visit by the foreign minister of Pakistan to India to meet with his counterpart. So you don't have to be Sherlock Holmes to figure out the coincidence there, that the military in Pakistan are concerned about detente with India. And there's obviously a tremendous economic logic, isn't there, to India and Pakistan trading more. They could also share energy pipelines from the stands that are coming online. There's a lot of reasons for them to cooperate, aren't there? And presumably, if their economies got more linked and intertwined and they had more connections at a political and social and cultural level, this would isolate the military who depend upon the joke about Pakistan is that it's not a country with an army, but an army with a country.
There actually is some good news on the subcontinent, and it's what you suggest. There are trade initiatives underway. The visa regime, especially for business types, is being liberalized. The infrastructure for trade is being improved. They still have a long, long way to go, but this is actually good news. My view is that if the government of India were wiser, more progressive, more far-sighted, it would pull a Gorbachev on Pakistan. That is to say, it would take away the enemy image and thereby completely undercut the military. It would do symbolic things. You remember some of the things that Gorbachev did. He accepted on-site inspections. And this was a no-no back in the mid-80s. He made unilateral cuts in his conventional forces. He made astounding diplomatic proposals. He said to us, I am going to take away your enemy image in you in the United States. What we have now in South Asia is a situation where everybody in Pakistan, knows that the economy is in terrible shape. And they know this is a nation of traders, people who trade. That's what they do. Their DNA is to trade. And their largest natural trading partner, next door, has been closed. It's now opening up. The government of India has said okay, absolutely okay, to increase trade. But it is slow-rolling Pakistan on other issues that matter to Pakistan. There are some territorial issues that have been hanging fire for decades that are easily solvable. They used to be considered low-hanging fruit. there's a glacier that these guys fight over and have deployed troops at ridiculous elevations. That could be demilitarized. They actually have an estuary that they argue about because of resources. It's called Sir Creek. The glacier is called Siachen. There are things that could be done. If the government of India took an initiative on Kashmir, it would have great reverberations in Pakistan. But the government of India is choked. It is immobilized almost. There's going to be a national election coming up, and they can't pull a Gorbachev at exactly the time when it would be most useful.
Well, just in closing, Michael Crapon, I recall when Ambassador Holbrooke took up this position to be the kind of overseer of that region, Afghanistan and Pakistan. When he started, he wanted to take on the Kashmir portfolio because he understood exactly what you're talking about, that the way to solve the problems in Pakistan and by extension in Afghanistan is to demilitarize and tamp down the competition with India. And what stymied that, and that he felt that that was the first thing to do, and what stymied that was the Indian lobby in the Congress, which is sort of somewhat modeled on the Israeli lobby. And, you know, a lot of observers of the tortured Middle East have argued that the U.S.'s relations with Israel is kind of an assisted suicide pact. And in the case of what happened with Holbrooke, it looks like the U.S.-India lobby's relationship is, you know, to a lesser degree, suicidal.
New Delhi does go ballistic whenever an American official talks about a Kashmir settlement. And for decades, it has been a catechism in Washington that the best way to facilitate a settlement, and it does not take a great gift of prophecy to figure out what the outlines of a Kashmir settlement would look like, by the way. But it has been a catechism that the best way to facilitate this is to stand back and to let the Pakistanis deal with the Indians directly. That had a logic to it a while ago. But if the government of India is not in the least bit inclined to do anything to facilitate a settlement in Kashmir, then the logic of standing back and being aloof is less appealing to me. Look, I don't think that in the second Obama administration, anybody in the stratosphere of policy-making circles is going to say, let's tackle Kashmir. It's not going to happen. But I think it's, it therefore becomes the role of think tanks, policy entrepreneurs, to kind of rattle a few cages on this. And that's certainly what I intend to do.
Well, Michael Crapon, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Ian, it's always a pleasure. Take care.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Michael Crapon, who's the founder and president emeritus of the Henry L. Stimson Center. He directs programming at the Stimson Center on South Asia Arms Control and Space Security. And previously, he worked in the Carter administration on Capitol Hill and at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He has written and edited more than a dozen books, including Cooperative Threat Reduction, Missile Defense, and The Nuclear Future, Space Assurance or Space Dominance, The Case Against Weaponizing Space, Nuclear Risk Reduction in South Asia, and Better Safe Than Sorry, The Ironies of Living with the Bomb. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me and I'll answer your questions. The conversation continues at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.